Hour number two of the program here. No, we're a little late, but fascinating conversation with David Sampson of Nothing Personal. He's always really fun to go back and forth with on the state of baseball and the state of new media and things like that. Really, really informed and intelligent conversation there. If you missed it, check it out on the Odyssey app. We have a busy, busy 7 o'clock hour. Got a couple of guests that are going to stop by, so I want to make sure we get this in before I get sidetracked and push it back even further. So let's waste no time on Chris Thomas tonight and get to five true, false questions, questions, questions.
So full disclosure, my list that I had last night, I don't know where I put it, so I'm going to try to remember these as best as I can, these questions. So here we go.
See, Oren, you need to take the time at the end of the day to put away all your stuff.
I got to put away my stuff.
Like, it's just like in kindergarten when the teacher yells at you for leaving your cubby a mess.
Well, here's the thing. Like, I had it sitting over here, my show sheet with my questions yesterday, because I left it out. So, like, I will put this in my little cubby over there, and I'll be good to go. Yeah, I totally forgot it. I just sit next to the phone, and I'm sure somebody very politely tossed it out because it's keeping our area as clean as possible. In any case,
well, sir, at least that's happening.
Yeah,
that hasn't always happened. That's
there's
for
a
sure.
Plus. There's a plus. Okay. Question number one, sir. Question number one. Vegas has the Falcons at 7.5 wins, the over-under for next season. If the Falcons are at 7 or 8, around that 7.5 number, there's going to be some firings in the front office, true or false, this offseason.
Everybody. Everybody not named Arthur Blank. Gone. Again, we talked about this yesterday, Oren. My benchmark for this team is 10 wins. So if you only win 7 or 8, that is an epic failure. That is an unmitigated disaster. That is something that I don't think anybody on this staff comes back from. I think you would have to wipe the whole thing clean because that means that nothing worked. The plan for Penix didn't work. The defensive draft didn't work. And essentially, I think you'd be starting from scratch. So I'm going to say absolutely wholesale changes if they don't win 9-10 games minimum and make the playoffs.
All righty, so I'm leaving Braylon Trice off of this list because he's recovering from injury, but let's take Arnold Ebiketie. Let's take James Pierce. Let's take Jalen Walker. Let's take Leonard Floyd. So those are your four, let's say your four primary edge rushers as of right now on this Falcons football team. Those four guys are going to combine for at least 27 sacks this season, true or false?
Okay, now we got to do math. Ugh. So
that's an average of about 7 apiece right there, almost 7 apiece.
Yeah. They better, man. Because then who's the one that's going to have, if not, then who's the one that's going to have the outsized number to make
the outlier, so to speak?
Is Leonard Floyd going to pop for 15?
Arnold's getting close to that 7 mark, I guess. Leonard has gone over the 7 mark before. So, I mean, I don't think you need to get crazy over if, say, Jalen and James both have 6 apiece. Arnold has 8, and Leonard has 9. That's 17.
The only thing that
29 sacks right there between the four if that happens.
What scares me about that, though, is the number that Joe Patrick told us in the first hour.
The rookies have 4.5 sacks. Yeah. They'd be lucky to get 4.5 sacks.
Yeah. So that's not promising. But I'm going to be optimistic, and I'm going to say I'm sticking with my theme here. It's true. They go over, and the defense turns it around this year.
All right, so this question was not on my list last night, but in doing some Dukes and Bell research today, found some intriguing over-under numbers for one Michael Penix Jr. Currently right now, he sits at 18.5 touchdown passes for the season.
What?
His over-under.
What?
And approximately 3,400 yards passing.
Oh, my God.
So 18.5 touchdowns, 3,400 yards passing. Let's take those both individually. Are you buying both of those overs or unders? Yes or no for his passing yards at 3,400 and his touchdowns at 18.5. We'll call those questions 3 and 4.
Oren, 18? I mean, there's. I guess that's why Vegas thinks the Falcons are going to win 7 games. Because if Michael Penix Jr. has 18 touchdowns.
Carl and Mike thought that maybe this means he's going to be more of a game manager and you're going to see the ball in the hands of Bijan and Tyler Algier a whole lot more.
But even game managers throw more than 18 touchdowns in 2025. I mean, what's it? Let me ask you. Let me spin it back to you. If you had to determine, give me passing yards, touchdowns, and interceptions, what is considered a good season in 2025 for a quarterback? Not great. Good.
You got to be right at 4,000.
4,000 yards.
Or just under 4,000.
24,
25, 26 touchdowns.
Touchdowns.
You got to average like a touchdown and a half a game.
And under 13, 14 interceptions?
Yeah. You need to have 10 less interceptions than you do touchdowns.
Okay. 18, Oren. 18.
That's the number. 18 and a half, yeah.
Come on, man. The ye of little freaking faith.
Shout out to Vegas, man.
No.
It opened, by the way, it opened at 19 and a half, and it's gone down since then.
Shout into Vegas, not shout out to Vegas. Keep your opinions in those stained glass, very expensive doors and windows that you have in Vegas. No, Michael Penix Jr., is going to throw for 4,100 yards, 27 touchdowns, and 13 interceptions. Book it. Book it. I don't want to hear about it. Get that out of my life. I don't want to hear those stats ever again, Oren. That made me angry. 18?
18 touchdowns,
come on,
sir.
Man.
18 touchdowns.
Get the bleep out of here with that.
They had Desmond Ridder his first year. I think it was either 14.5 or 15.5.
Okay, that's Desmond Ridder, though. That's fine. We've seen what's become of his NFL career.
Technically a second-year starter in Michael Penix. His first full season as a starter, but his second year in the NFL.
18?
18 interceptions. I mean, 18 touchdowns.
Come on. 18? He better have 18 by week like 11 or 12.
Well, you talked about that the defense need to kind of pull its weight a little bit more. If we're going to have a 3,400-yard passing season with 18 touchdowns.
No, we're not.
That defense better be doing a whole lot.
Kirk Cousins had 18 touchdowns last year, and he was broken in half.
He went, 5 weeks without throwing a touchdown?
Yeah, and he still finished with 18 touchdowns. 18?
18.
Come on, Oren. All right, one more real quick. Ugh.
Sorry.
Disgusting.
All right, so since we're on Michael Penix Jr. right here, the Falcons finish next year with 3 receivers over 900 receiving yards.
900.
That would put him at 2,700 passing yards, just under the 3,400 passing yard threshold that Vegas says he has.
If it's not Pitts, who would it be? That's the question, right? Could Bijan Robinson have 900 yards out of the backfield?
Darnell.
Well, I'm counting Darnell.
You
count
Darnell and Dre. Okay.
As 2.
No Ray Ray.
900. That's 900. That's a lot for Ray Ray. Maybe. I mean, is Casey Washington going to come out of nowhere? And who's the kid that was the quarterback that they're high on? Nelson or something?
Oh, the kid from San Diego. San Jose State.
Yeah, whatever his name is. I'm going to say no. Because I feel like it has to be Pitts.
This true or false has gone to a very, very dark place
well,
very quickly.
Because, like, there's really no other person that makes sense if it's not going to be Pitts. And Pitts has never come close to that except for once. And that was his rookie year. You know what? Fine. True. Pitts, you're welcome. I'm giving you undue credit.
Hey, man, according to Dukes and Bell, the montage-style video he did to kind of get himself ready for the season just may pay dividends.
Can I be honest?
What you got?
He's done a couple of things off the field that have kind of turned my cheek the wrong way, so to speak.
Go on.
First of all, going on that podcast a couple of months ago and describing himself as an elite level talent, I think was a giant misstep. Obviously saying I just work here was a giant misstep. And now this. So, Kyle, can we focus on ball, please? How about we do that first? All right, we got a really busy 7 o'clock hour coming up for you here. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Let's keep the Falcons convo going. Will McFadden's going to join me next, senior writer and editor of AtlantaFalcons.com. A little training camp preview. Don't go anywhere. Your home for Falcons training camp is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. We are just mere hours at this point away from Falcons training camp getting underway. Of course, we have all things covered pillar to post every day right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. And my next guest on Chris Thomas Tonight, Turtle, with you till 10 o'clock. Will McFadden will be there as well, senior writer and editor for AtlantaFalcons.com. Will, all right, we have made it. Been a long off season, but here we are. What are your two or three biggest storylines you are looking forward to tackling on the first couple of days here of camp?
Yeah, we are. We're here, Chris. It's exciting. This is one of the, I feel like, more unknown teams that I've covered in a little while, because obviously, and this is my number one storyline, is Michael Penix and the offense, right? I think various models have been debated about the best way to build an offense, knowing how important the quarterback position is. It's, you know, you start with the young quarterback and then you maximize the rookie contract and you use that money to build everything around him, or you drop a young quarterback into a ready-made system. And that's kind of what the Falcons are doing here. So how quickly he can get up to like a cohesive chemistry with his top weapons, that's going to be number one. Number two, honestly, when it looks, maybe I can just say like how the defensive rookies really acclimate themselves, specifically Billy Bowman and Xavier Watts, because those are going to be the two guys I think we can get the best feel for early, especially before the pads come on, is kind of that secondary group. And then, you know, here's a little bit of an under the radar one, but one that I think will kick up a little bit, especially when the preseason games get going, is just that kicker battle. I still have all the confidence in the world in the Younghoe Koo, but they brought Lenny Craig in for a reason. There's going to be a competition. Raheem Morris said they need to get better there. So, you know, we could say Kyle Pitts, we could say the pass rushers, all that stuff. But I do think, in this league, when everything's a one-score game, getting that kicker spot right this year, again, if that's Koo, if that's Krieg, that's going to be important.
How close of an eye are you going to have on Ryan Neuzel, the new center?
Yeah, that's a great one as well. Not maybe as close as I would had it been somebody brand new. But, you know, it's something that we didn't maybe discuss enough kind of with the incoming of a new offense in Zach Robinson's group last year, is that they did really keep a lot of the run concepts and schemes the same and married that between coordinators, with Dwayne Ledford, the run game coordinator, TJ Yates, pass game coordinator, and then Zach Robinson. So if anything, I think more of the learning curve was on the coaching staff. Therefore, you know, it's the same scheme that Ryan Neuzel has been in his whole career. He got 8 games with the group last year. I'll be looking at it, but, you know, I expect him to kind of step right in there and keep that group going strong.
With the uncertainty of Kyle Pitts, as you mentioned, with Michael Penix Jr. being, for all intents and purposes, you know, his first full starting season in the NFL, do you expect Bijan Robinson to be used a lot more out of the backfield as a safety valve?
That's a great instinct. And the reason I say that is because knowing really specifically more what Michael Penix liked to do at Washington, which was he's a big game hunter. He likes to throw it deep. He likes to throw it down the sidelines. In the NFL, if you can do that, if you have that arm strength, defenses will try to put that 10 up on you. They'll run cover 4. They'll run cover 2. That's going to open up not only space in the run game for Bijan Robinson, but I do really like what it opens up in the screen game potentially, or in some of these outlet passes. So yes, I do think you'll see an expanded maybe version of Atlanta's offense in that way, but a lot of it is going to come down to Michael Penix. And one of the early, I think, criticisms I had of Desmond Ridder was take the easy stuff, take what they're giving you. It's something I thought Kirk Cousins did a very good job of, being a veteran quarterback. But you know, maybe that too much times. I think that Michael Penix striking the right balance between taking those shots deep, making the defense respect you, but then getting it out to your best guys quickly in the design of the play and how it evolves. Yep, I think that is definitely going to be part of this offense this year.
So how quickly do you anticipate Zach Robinson, I'll use the word unleash, whatever term you want to use, Michael Penix in the season, or do you think it's going to be a slow buildup and progression over the first couple of games?
Yeah, that will really, I think, depend on a couple of things. How much of this offense is new? And by that, I mean, you know, how much of it is added from what they looked at over this offseason, maybe scouting what Michael Penix Jr. did in college. So it may be familiar to your quarterback, but it might be new to the other 10 pieces around him. So how much of the offense is new? Because that will dictate just kind of the height of the learning curve, if you will. And then I really think a lot of it will just depend on the chemistry. How quickly does he get up to speed with these guys? Because that was really the one thing holding him back last year, understandably so. But the more that he's able to prove to the coaching staff, I know where these guys are going to be. We have a good chemistry. We speak the same language. You can trust us. The more I think the coaching staff will kind of open up maybe more of the nuanced things and maybe give, yeah, I don't want to speak too far out of term, but I could see that leading to a more advanced playbook and a broader menu of plays. And so then, you know, that goes back to the first question of just how much is new with this offense. If it's really kind of what he studied last year, he's got the input from Kirk, training camp is just refining. You could see him hit the ground running in week one and maybe be one of these teams that starts 3-1, you know, 4-0, and is kind of like the talk of the town. There's always a couple of those teams. You could also very well see a slower build and you're 1-2, but the offense is putting together, you know, some nice momentum and you feel good about it. So I could really see it going a variety of ways.
I know this is something we talked about as the summer progressed, but are you surprised? I'll use the word surprised very specifically. Are you surprised that the Falcons were as comfortable as they were with keeping the receiving core essentially intact from last year and not making any major or notable additions to the room?
I would not say that I was surprised because as I kind of had my off-season checklist, receiver was on there, but it was always on there in the way of like, okay, it's after the draft. Now maybe you research late and shoot. Maybe this is still the case. You just kind of know that, yeah, it's something we'd like to add to. They like to say, you know, we're always scouring the waiver wires. We're always looking at every roster to find ways to get better. If you feel like, hey, we could upgrade over, you know, Kadarius Hodge, and now he is just your core special teamer and find somebody else there. We could, you know, find another wrinkle player like Ray McLeod, like what have you. Sure. But that was always going to be lower on my list because of the relative financial restrictions that they had this offseason and kind of the other needs that they entered with. And I don't think it's surprising that they pretty much went defense this entire offseason in the draft and in free agency with their bigger moves, I think you could say. So that all tells me that they felt comfortable making Michael Penix the differentiator between last year and this year on offense, because a lot of the other pieces, like we don't talk about enough how historic last season's run game was in terms of like efficiency on a per play basis. They were one of the best in like modern NFL history. So you add that, or you add Michael Penix to that, and you hope that it adds another dynamic element. That alone might be enough, and this offense has plenty of weapons. So I wasn't surprised. You can make the argument they needed to, but when you look across the table, I think it was relatively low on that list.
Talking all things Falcons with Will McFadden, senior writer and editor at AtlantaFalcons.com. When it comes to the defensive rotation, I know it's really difficult in practices. They switch things up a lot to sort of get a gauge for who's going to get how much run. But what guys specifically are you looking at in terms of who are going to be the anchors for the defensive line?
Yep. I think with Grady Jarrett no longer here, David Onyemata kind of slots into that like veteran kind of leader, focal point, whatever you want to say, of the defensive line. Then around him, you've got to expect Rick Roro to kind of step into maybe that Grady Jarrett role. I would look at a player like Zach Harrison. You know, Kentavious Street is another veteran who probably is going to be a part of that rotation. The player that I am, and I've got a piece coming out tomorrow naming a few of the players that I feel kind of like need to have a pretty good training camp. And among them is Brandon Dorlus. And he, to me, is a little bit of the wild card in this mix. He was a healthy scratch for a lot of last year, but I don't necessarily think that's an indictment on his ability. I think that was more an approach by the team and also an indicator of kind of where they did have some of that veteran depth. Like the defensive line coming out of camp, I was like, I don't know where I'm going to make any of these cuts. they're going to take 12 defensive linemen into the season. So for that reason, he got a chance to learn and grow. He's a versatile player. When he was at Oregon, played kind of all over the place and was effective at doing so. So if he has a big camp, I actually think that unlocks a lot of different opportunities for Atlanta's defensive line. But early on, I would really expect it to be probably David Onyemata, Zach Harrison, and Ruka Roro as your interior three. And then when they go to a four-man front, it's probably either Kentavious Street, you know, maybe we see Taquan Graham if he's able to step up at all, but those guys. And we'll see what Braylon Trice can do where he comes back from injury, but he's probably going to be on the edge anyway.
How much are you expecting to see of Watts and Bowman getting reps with the ones?
Who is the Xavier Watts? Yes. I think they will probably start out with the twos to begin with for maybe the first couple of blocks of camp. If they don't, that is, I think, a great indicator of how they performed in minicamp and OTAs and kind of in the classroom specifically. Because again, this is throughout the afternoon, some of your callers have been bringing up the 2016 draft. Like I'm going to be doing a little bit of digging back into that class as I do from time to time, just to really refresh myself because it feels like it could have that type of impact. And I know, of course, that one, Deion Jones pretty much started training camp at middle linebacker, and that drew a lot of buzz. Don't think Xavier Watts is lining up in Caden Ellis's spot, but I think you'll see him out there a good bit. Same with Billy Bowman. Honestly, if I had to just throw something out that might make sense, joint practices against the Titans, that could be a fun situation to really kind of get them in the mix that week and see what they can do. So we'll see. But if they start out there on Thursday, kind of with the ones, I would take that as a very good sign about how comfortable this staff feels with those two guys.
All right. Before I let you go, Raheem and Terry are obviously set to speak both within the next couple of days. Do you think the tone of those conversations is going to be more spoken about the pressure of them on this season, or is it going to be about the excitement of this season, or do you feel like it'll be a mixture of both?
knowing Raheem, not incredibly well, but having been around him, you know, enough, he's always probably going to lean on the excitement side. He is a naturally optimistic, charismatic. You know, he wants to, I think, be at his best. And so he's going to bring his best attitude and energy to everything because that kind of helps all of us perform, honestly. Like if you're relaxed, if you're comfortable, if you feel in command. And so that is 100% the attitude and tone I expect from them. Frankly, I think they're going to be excited for good reason. You know, in talking to some of the players during minicamp, like there is a sense of internal confidence I feel with this group. Which you kind of have to have. Every team is going to come into camp, but this one feels a little bit more real to me than maybe in some years. So I would expect Raheem and Terry to echo that and kind of set that tone when they speak to the media.
Appreciate it, Will. We'll be excited to see you up there in just a couple of days. Get your sunscreen ready, and we'll meet out on the hill.
Yep, get the sun hats out, bring the fans, but looking forward to seeing you and the fans at training camp this weekend.
All right. We'll chat soon, Will. That is Will McFadden of AtlantaFalcons.com. All right. When we get back, let's turn our attention to the world of college football. Media days are still going on. We'll chat with one of our favorites, Ian Valentino of A to Z Sports to do that. More next. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, Odyssey app. It's Chris Thomas tonight. ACC Media Day is going on right now. SEC Media Days have come and gone. Big Ten Media Days have come and gone. We are rocking and rolling on our way to college football. And here to talk about it on Chris Thomas Tonight, Turtle, with you till 10 o'clock, is one of our favorites, Ian Valentino from A to Z Sports. Make sure you check out his work there, covering all things college football and the NFL draft. Ian, do you think, we'll go back to SEC Media Days here to recap a couple of things that I wanted to chat with you about. Do you think that the SEC is going to move to a 9-game conference schedule sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I think if I was going to guess, I think so. There's going to be incentive to do it. I do think that the ideas of, the other conferences trying to get them on the same page, trying to promote more big matchups, which just means eventually, more money. It evens things out a little bit when you're looking at trying to protect certain rivalries and maybe bring back old rivalries. Like, the fans certainly aren't the driving force, unfortunately, but I do think this is a situation where both sides can win, where the fans get what they want and maybe see some more premier matchups. And then, alternatively, these conferences are going to make a little bit more money too. So that's always what drives it. And I do think that there's enough there to say that that should be enough of an incentive to make it happen.
And then off of that, you have Kurt Cignetti spouting off today that they're going to go to an SEC type schedule because they want to make sure, they pad their own stats. maybe they should win something first before they open their mouth like that. Or do you think do you think he had a point?
Yeah, I think he does, right? Because that's the one knock on the SEC that everyone can say is that they are guilty of, come November, a lot of teams are playing these FCS teams, or there's 4, 5, 6 touchdown favorites. And so it is what it is. I mean, the SEC, they beat up on each other. And so that's a little bit self-fulfilling too. And that's not necessarily their fault, but we know the SEC is really good. I think sometimes it's okay to take a shot. It's funny. And I think there's a little bit of truth behind it too. So to me, it's all in good fun. And I'm sure he'd like some of the perks of being in the SEC too. It's not like, I don't think that was just a blind shot where he's thinking that the Big Ten is infallible either.
I see Mario Cristobal making the rounds now. How much pressure is on him coming off of a season where you had the number one pick in the draft and now you get a highly touted transfer in Carson Beck? Do they have the horses behind them this season to really compete, do you think?
I think they do. They've got a lot of talent outside of Beck, and I really don't know what to expect from Beck this season. I think he'll probably be at least average, but coming off of a major injury, and then he's had an interesting off season, and a little bit older guy, didn't have an amazing season last year. They're a defensive first team though. They're a team that has to win in the trenches. They've recruited really well there. Like, that's Mario Cristobal. I will say, like, for all of the in-game stuff that'll drive you nuts, he's pretty good at building up teams in the where it really matters, and the meat and potatoes of things. And so they're a good team. I don't know that they're going to be, more dangerous than last year. They might be more well-rounded than last year, but I don't know that they have the upside that Cam Ward brought them and their playmaking. They had a lot of Elijah Arroyo breaking out. How do you replace someone like that? I don't really know. It's not like they added a true superstar receiver. So good team. They should get 10 wins if Carson Beck is good. But if they fell short in the traditional Miami way, I don't know that I'd be shocked either.
What are your expectations after, everything that happened this offseason aside, what is your expectation for North Carolina on the field?
You'd expect them to be disciplined. You'd expect them to be, I think they'll probably be more progressive than what most people would think. I do think that Belichick gets away from being more predictable than not. I think there is maybe a thought that they'll be just conservative and just run the ball and under center and all these things, but they have the talent to be more dynamic than that. I think he's done a good job throughout his career of building up staffs that really do maximize his players and their play styles instead of just trying to force whatever he wants to happen. So I think defensively they'll be pretty solid. They have good talent. They don't have the talent to win, the ACC. So they're going to, when they fall short, it'll be interesting to see like how patient he is with what he wants to do and how he reacts to maybe some negativity or maybe, the eventual cold spell that might come. at some point. But I think it'll be a good team. I think they might punch a little bit above their weight class, which is pretty hard to do, especially in year one of the ACC. Like, you know, it's a good conference this year. So I think they'll be good. I think 8-9 wins should be fair to expect. Yeah, I don't know that they have much upside beyond that unless the staff really goes above and beyond.
When it comes to the rest of the conference, as you said, you think it might be a deep one, but Clemson head and shoulders the top of the cream there?
I think so. Yeah, this looks like a great year for Clemson, and that team reminds me of when they were in their peak with their Deshaun Watson years, the Trevor Lawrence years. It took them a little bit of time because they were so young last year, but three of their last games, four losses last year, were to some of the best teams, most athletic teams in the country, South Carolina, Texas, and Georgia. The game they lost against Louisville was kind of weird, but that happens sometimes. I think maturity is going to be a big thing for them. I think they're in the top couple of teams of the returning starters. I want to say they have like 16 returning starters. Kate Klubnik's a big part of that, right? Like, they might have the top quarterback in the nation. Obviously, they have some really good playmaking. Their defensive line is elite again. So they're back into that spot where they should be a very high floor team, and those guys should really be able to take the next jump too throughout this season. So I think they are. They're going to hopefully be peaking at the right time, and be interesting to see Dabo kind of get back into this maybe second wind of his career after he had a couple of seasons that people weren't exactly thrilled about.
Before the season gets started here, who do you have as the best team in the Big Ten in your preseason?
I think it's Penn State. I don't want to put too much faith into like Drew Aller and a team that is led by James Franklin. I think both of those guys have their own demons that they've got to overcome. But the talent is certainly there. Adding Jim Knowles as defensive coordinator makes a lot of sense. Talk about returning production. I think they had 14 guys coming back. A lot of those guys were draft eligible and would have gone pretty high in the draft. A lot of those guys would have been top 100 picks. So it's really the Ohio State recipe. And then you went out and you added the Ohio State defensive coordinator. And so I think that's pretty good recipe for being strong. And then Ohio State, you know, they're, I think, obviously the number two. And then they're replacing about 70% of their starting lineup and then two coordinators. So they'll be great. But you do expect some hiccups alongside that too. So I just think Penn State has that veteran leadership. And I will say, you know, Franklin, he's got to get out of his own way. That's going to be the biggest thing. Can he get over the hump when it really matters?
Talking all things college football with our buddy Ian Valentino, A to Z Sports. Make sure you check him out there. Brian Kelly certainly had some interesting comments back at SEC Media Day talking about how this game is played for the athletes and not for the NIL and all this other stuff. But he also said one thing that I thought actually did make sense, Ian, and that was that he put it on the coaches. He said it's up to us to make sure that we, as the leaders of these programs, get the NIL and the transfer portal to a place where it's more manageable. Do you agree that the coaches should put a bigger hand into getting these things solved, or is it not their place to do so with the student athletes being their own sort of individual entities at this point?
I thought it was a pretty self-aware statement by Kelly, which is not always something you'd expect from him. I don't know that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, he makes that statement. I think he's right. I mean, these head coaches are oftentimes the highest paid individual within the state, especially for these state universities, and you know, Notre Dame isn't, but these state schools especially, there needs to be a level of transparency. There needs to be a level of awareness and responsibility that these guys have, especially over student athletes who really don't know much, and they may not be represented by the best people in the programs. You know, programs themselves have their own goals too. So, you know, I like it. It, you know, there's always gonna be a little bit of a conflict of interest there. You know, what can we get? How can we maximize what we have to work with? But I think he's right. Like, I think these guys need to be responsible, and if they delegate that, that's fine. But you're then responsible for how you delegate your processes. So, credit to him. I mean, I'm all for the guy making $10+ million a year having the responsibility at his feet.
Some off-the-field notes that are interesting. Jimbo Fisher has announced he's joining ACC Network. Are you surprised he doesn't have a job?
I think he'd have one if he wanted one. Like, I know Texas A&M flamed out, but he's a good coach. I mean, it just the number there with the buyout is what gets people, and deservedly so. I think if he wanted to take a solid job, maybe even, you know, he mentioned Kirsten Maddie, it's like Indiana, if he wanted like an Indiana level job, yeah, I think he'd walk into one of those jobs pretty easily. But for him, why? It is a step down. I don't know that at this point in his career there's much to prove. Obviously, the money speaks for itself. Is he really going to be able to walk back into an NIL-driven kind of landscape where things have changed even since he was fired and be able to hit the ground running pretty quickly without, you know, souring the fan base? Because I think there is that stigma whenever you're fired and you make $80 million in a buyout. That's an intense stigma, I think, to overcome. So I do think he's good enough to coach it. I think he'd have interest, but I think for his own sake, it's probably better that he just maybe walks into the analyst role.
All right, before I let you go, one other off-field note. The ACC announced they're going to report availability for conference games. What did you make of that announcement?
Overall, you know, I'm for it, right? I want to see how things change. I like seeing the opportunity to see things play out a little bit. I'm always going to be in favor of trying something, and then you can walk it back or flip the decision if it doesn't work out. So, yeah, I was a little bit surprised. I don't know that I expected it to go that way, but I guess we'll see, and we'll see how quickly, if they need to pull the lever to kind of pivot the other way. I'm interested to see if they're willing to.
What would be the downside of doing it? I think it's something in college. I mean, it's been long overdue. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes these things don't come out until literally the last second.
I don't know. I mean, from a content standpoint, I know that we're super excited for it because Exactly. Fans deserve to know. And obviously it's good for us to create content about it. And so I don't really know. I don't know why there hasn't been more of almost a requirement. I just think from a health standpoint too, like I just think there should be more transparency on that for everyone involved. And so maybe we're not owed that information. I don't know. Maybe if you wanted to look at it from that standpoint, like it's a privacy issue. But I think I'm reaching just to even get there from a program standpoint. Sure. I get being selfish about it. But in the interest of the game, that shouldn't be the case. There's always that shroud of gamesmanship, but it's like, I mean, I think these guys inside the buildings know, but it's not a surprise when star athlete X is limited in a game. Like we might be surprised at that from the outside, but these guys have, you know, connections all over the place. It's not surprising when they're working inside the building. So the only ones left in the dark are the fans and some of the media, but oftentimes it's like the announcement crew, they know. So it's just kind of funny, like why there's that shroud.
Ian, appreciate the time as always. We'll check you out at A to Z Sports. We'll chat soon.
Thanks so much. Have a great night.
All right. That is Ian Valentino there chopping up college ball from A to Z Sports. I'm excited to play this audio when we get back. I emailed Oren. I was like, yo, we need these two clips. I don't know why he did this. I don't know if I would have done it. But J.C. Tretter, yes, the dude who just stepped down as the NFLPA executive, went on Dan Patrick today and did an interview. Yeah, we're going to play some of that for you next. Don't go anywhere. Chris Thomas tonight.